going to talk about ideas that people have to combat prostitution and what prostitution is about in the United States of America. I'm going to combine a lot of studies, sociological studies, in today's class, but we'll talk a little bit about some ideas people have come up with to work with prostitution and combat it. And then at the very end, we'll talk about Genesis House, which is one of those ideas that is working and is very successful. So, prostitution in the United States. When you think about prostitution, does it conjure up visions of Richard Gere and Julia Roberts shopping on Rodeo Drive, happily getting married and running off into the sunset? Or maybe it's, you know, a Hollywood happening with, you know, Charlie Sheen and Heidi Fleiss, and maybe even Hugh Grant shows up for that. So, you know, that's some of the media attention we get in this country around prostitution. But I'd like to begin today with a poem by a woman who was an outreach worker for us. She's a recovered prostitute and drug addict. She's HIV positive, and for about the past more than a year now, she's been too sick to work. She also has hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to introduce this poem to you. It's been presented in Washington at the HIV conferences, and I think it sort of gives you a more real feeling what prostitution feels like for a lot of people. The poem is called Fill the Void, and it is by Sabrina Tate. Feeling left out, don't fit in school, had to read out loud and felt like a fool. They laughed at me and chased me home, and I sat on the stairway all alone. I couldn't ask my mama to help me fight, because Daddy hit her in a rage last night. Made up my mind right around then, I'll never go back. I'll just pretend. I'll tell everybody I really don't care. School ain't nothing. That teacher ain't fair. I'm ditching school, just hanging out. Being with my friends, that's what it's all about. Pam says I'm cool, and Coltrane says I'm fine. They gave me some blow, and we drank some wine. I'm going over to Coltrane's house. They got some stuff that'll really knock you out. Street lights, bar stools, and plenty of cash. Give me another bag so I can make this last. Slick red tailor-made suits, mini skirts, and patent leather boots. Take me, love me, make me whole. Fill this void down in my soul. Scratching and nodding, bent to the floor. Turning tricks and looking real slick. Nose running, gotta steal something, because I'm starting to feel real sick. So many days, so many years, using dope to kill my fears. So much pain and so much sorrow, hating myself and dreading tomorrow. Running, falling, crashing down. All my friends buried in the cold, hard ground. Scuffling, hungry, need a $10 bill. Need a fix so bad, I'm ready to kill. Oh God, help me, don't leave me alone. With all of this HIV down in my bones. What do I have to do? What do I have to give? I don't want to die. I want to live. Please don't let me die this way. Teach me to live just for one day. Take me, heal me, make me whole. Fill this void that's down in my soul. Keep me sober and living clean. Raise my faith and my self-esteem. Take me back to the schoolroom door. Help me learn to read once more. Give me 12 long steps to heaven and an HIV message that I pray I can pass along to others when they come this way. Take me, mold me, use me, Lord, to help other addicts who you love and adore. I think that's a beautiful poem. So I wanted to start out, and she did recover and was one of our very best outreach workers. So I talked a little bit about the stereotypes in the beginning and wanted to tell you that these stereotypes just cannot be further from the truth. Prostitution, as this poem so beautifully depicts, is really a sad, painful life that began out of limited opportunities. Most of these women are tragic victims of childhood emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. They are misunderstood and marginalized as citizens in our country, and then they get into this downward spiral of addictions. They are routinely shot, stabbed, robbed, raped, defecated on, urinated on, thrown from moving cars, and left for dead in dumpsters and alleys around our cities. They are your mothers, your daughters, and your sisters. And don't be fooled. We had a woman in our program who was recruited from Minnesota on her college campus. So you never know where it's going to happen or where it is in your society. Some people in society think that, well, if all these things happen to the women, they really have it coming, don't they? They put themselves in harm's way. And what's really sad about that is some of the women feel that way too. So what else is it? It's really big business. According to the U.S. News and World Report, and this is several years ago, so it's higher now, it is more than $40 million in revenue daily. Not monthly, not annually, daily. That is more than $14.6 billion annually in revenue. It is big, big business. There are nearly 2 million working prostitutes in the United States of America. They work in small towns and big cities. We, in fact, at Genesis House, did the state training for HIV outreach to prostitution, and we had to totally change what we did because in the smaller towns, a lot of times, the women worked as prostitutes at truck stops and places like that where there were different kind of visibility, so we had to change our approach to understand what the culture was and how it was different in small towns. In large city, you see 20% of them on the street. In smaller towns, it's more like 50% of the women are on the street. The other places are massage parlors, escort services, and brothels, and most anywhere you have tourism business. So in Chicago, you would see a lot of that around hotels, a lot around the McCormick Place where the big meetings happen and so on, and the women will actually go into those rooms at those cocktail parties and begin to circulate the room and work around there. Most people in prostitution are women and girls. However, in larger cities, you see more males and transgenders. This is especially true in San Francisco, where the rate of male and boy and transgender prostitutes is 20 to 25%. From a sociological perspective, there's all kinds of different definitions come up. This one is, I think, a pretty good one. It says that it's a cultural practice that begins when sex crosses the line from a gift given, as we discussed last night, the positive aspects of sex and how it is a gift, to an exchange as a commodity. So it crosses that line. It is an extreme form of a double standard in our country. It's trading sex for money, drugs, even a place to sleep. A person can be prostituting themselves if they're homeless and desperate. It's a double standard that's justified by some males in the establishment, and it's a way of separating the good girls, in other words, our wives and daughters, from the bad girls, which is the girls who provide for our sexual needs. So what does it cost? Does it cost anything? I mean, why should we really care about it? Yes, we know it costs emotionally, as we talked about. We know it costs spiritually. It costs children. It costs everyone involved. But it costs a lot of money, too. And what are the direct costs to the taxpayers in our country? Community policing. The police are out doing this, which is a nonviolent crime that the women are supposedly committing when they really should be doing other things. I mean, let's face it. Where would you rather have your police? Stopping murders or out picking up women on corners? You really have to think, we have a limited number of police, and is this really the thing for them to be doing every day? It costs in court time. It costs in incarceration. In San Francisco, it costs $7.6 million annually. In New York City, it costs $23 million annually to do this. That does not even take in HIV, healthcare, social service costs, any of that. That doesn't take in any of that. That's just court, police, and arrests. It also costs, as we know, with HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and hepatitis C. There are still, believe it or not, and it's frequent, a lot of customers who say, I'll pay you more not to wear a condom at this day and age. And a woman who needs drugs and wants money will go ahead and acquiesce to that. the children are neglected and abused, and beyond that, so you've got this whole group of children that now, in fact, it may be a surprise to you, 75% of women in prostitution have children under the age of 18. And I remember one of my older board members saying to me, "What? Children?" She never thought about children. And I said, "Well, you know, when you think about it, they're doing a lot of the activity that produces children. So it's no surprise that we have kids." So a lot of these kids end up in foster homes. There also know statistically that 50% of children that grow up with an incarcerated parent will end up being incarcerated themselves. So bring that cost into society. Not to mention the fact that they're not paying any taxes. If you're really into taxes, they're not paying taxes. And these are women that can be retrained and learn jobs and become citizens and work. So also, the emotional toll that it takes on them, their families, and their children. And many times at graduations, at Genesis, we see how grateful the family is and how happy and supportive. These are not nameless, faceless people without families and sisters and brothers and fathers and cousins and children. They deeply care a lot of times about their family members, and they want to see them succeed. So some might also argue it's a matter of choice. Is it really a matter of choice when the average age of entry is 14 years old? What type of a choice did you make at 14? Did you make a choice that would keep you going for the rest of your life, that would get you raped and beaten and exposed to disease? Were you really capable of making that choice at 14 years old? So the average age is 14 to 18, usually closer to 14. A child has to weigh out. There's danger at home, and there's danger on the streets. Which danger do I want to be in today? And sometimes that becomes a runaway situation where the average child in this country is approached within 48 hours of entry to a large city for prostitution, usually at the bus station. There are pimps just patrolling, looking for these runaways. And they usually have survival sex to just keep going, feed their children, and they have histories of physical and sexual abuse. 78% have histories of physical abuse, 85% have histories of sexual abuse. So there becomes a predisposition of victimization, which then allows, it becomes okay in some way in their mind. That doesn't make it okay. They're also coerced by pimps in their home environments. And as I said, there's college recruiting, there's high school recruiting, there are pimps actively looking for women. There's actually a film, which I saw when I was in Washington, D.C. on business, which I turned out it happened to be the Pimp's Ball, which I thought was pretty bizarre because I was there for funding for Genesis House. And they go into these pimps and how many women they have. And the one thing the man says, which made me listen, is he said, we look for women with low self-esteem that we can control. And that's what we look for, and that's what we prey on. So I thought there was at least one honest moment in this film about glorifying pimps. The statistics I just read to you were actually by Portland's Sexual Exploitation Project, where there's a lot of activity in Washington State and Portland. And then again, gradually people accept victimization. It becomes okay because they don't know any other type of lifestyle, and they've never been treated well. They also begin to believe that it's the only thing they're good at is performing sex acts. Also from that, you begin the psychological problems of sexual addictions or sexual compulsivity, which we're now recognizing as an addiction in its own that needs to be treated. And we do have Prostitutes Anonymous, for example, at Genesis House as one of our 12-step groups. And they also suffer, as we know, from post-traumatic stress syndrome. At Genesis House, we see depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder and personality disorders the most in terms of psychological impact of living this lifestyle. From the Journal of Interpersonal Violence from 1998, which did an extensive research study on this, they listed the antecedents to prostitution, and I think this is important. And the reason I'm arming all of you with this knowledge is so when somebody says to you, "Why don't we just make it legal?" you will have a really good response to that. Number one, childhood sexual abuse, which I've mentioned, childhood physical abuse, running away from home, poor family functioning or dysfunctional families, parental violence, parental substance abuse and drug use, childhood substance abuse and drug use, and the universal denominator is low self-esteem. So for those who say prostitution is a free choice in our society, you need to think about, is the devaluation and objectification of women a free choice? Prostitution is female sexual slavery wherever it is legalized, regulated, or tolerated. So violence in the void, it's just this violent lifestyle. And why do I say it's violence in the void, as in Sabrina's poem, The Void, and I tie in our In the Wilderness. The poem is in the void, it's violence in the void. Why? Because there's really nobody there to help you. First of all, 80% are physically assaulted. Most are raped more than 10 times per year. 20% are abused by people who have identified themselves as police officers. So whether or not they are, but there are some quotes that I'm not going to go into from an Anchorage study, which said the rookies come in starting to treat the women nicely, and then down the road they become abusive after a little while on the police force. And as I've already told you, some of the customers are judges, politicians, detectives, and police officers, and lawyers, and big businessmen. So they identify as police officers and they abuse them, hold them hostage. The women are homeless. They're homeless, so they are visible and they are available. So they're on the streets with no protection. The rate of murder of prostitution has skyrocketed across the country, and you know I referred to the Green River Killer. We had two serial killers in Chicago that we worked with the FBI on, and it's substance abusers have a higher rate of being assaulted. Crack cocaine has the highest rate of being murdered, and women have, and transgenders, interestingly enough, have a higher rate than males of being murdered. On a Canadian report on prostitution and pornography told us that it has a 40% higher average of mortality than any other group. Most prostitutes never report to the police. They call it a bad date. And what is a bad date? That's someone who assaults you, robs you, rapes you, or someone who simply doesn't pay. It's men who pose as clients and then end up doing something horrific to you. They can actually justify it. Some people actually justify this violence, saying to themselves, I'm doing society a favor because it's illegal and I can rationalize my violence against these people. It's rationalized because it's a moral, political marginalization of people. And they feel like, well, if I'm ridding the streets of prostitutes, I should be given a blue ribbon for this by the police. The predators who target prostitutes feel that they won't be reported because the prostitutes won't be credible witnesses and they won't be believed. So they feel they can get away with that kind of violence and crime. What about the arrests? Well, the women are arrested 10 to 1 to the customers to 5 to 1, depending on what city you live in. Which means, again, that the women are costing society a lot of money to arrest and incarcerate and do all these things too. The men, on the other hand, or the customers, when they're arrested, contribute to the bottom line because of the tickets, fines, cars being towed, etc. Yet, we continue to discriminate against the women. I really think there should be much more focus on the men because, number one, they are the customer. They are there of free will. They are there of free choice. They have the power of control, and they have the ability to stop if they got the proper intervention. So why is there rarely any focus on that? And we'll talk about that in our Genesis house. Then you have pimps. You have the pimps who dominate, they abuse, and they introduce the woman to drugs when you're trafficked, sometimes forcibly. Sometimes a woman must meet a quota, and if she doesn't meet her quota that day, she's going to pay for that. Some of the pimps are surprisingly parents or partners, husbands, partners on drugs who send her out to prostitute. We've had calls from the Chicago school system that says we have a girl on drugs. Her father, she's in seventh grade, eighth grade, her father's sending her out to prostitute to get money for drugs. What can we do? So it's not always some person way out there, it's someone you know. The women have to maintain a low profile. That's another reason they don't report the crimes and these people aren't stopped. There's no witnesses against these people. So sometimes they have pending bench warrants. They're already in trouble with the law. They have previous arrests. They have an illegal immigration status. So it's very difficult for them to come forward and put any of these people who perpetrate these crimes in jail. They've also had previous poor experience with police and courts. The police aren't exactly their best friends, and they don't have a lot of trust or faith in that system because of all the things that have happened to them, probably from juvenile experiences on up. So there's no trust there. Also, you know, when we work with CAPS, the society's interpretation is so negative. All they ever say to us, which is the community policing, they say, well, we want them off the corners. We want them off the corners, you know. And the offenders don't get properly penalized when they're caught, the men. So we think, okay, if everybody in society, we can all kind of agree and maybe come to that starting point and say, I don't want my child to see this when I go to school. I don't want this in my neighborhood. The business owner says I don't want this in front of my business. Somebody else says my property values are going down. There's got to be a better solution than incarceration. Incarceration has an 80% recidivism rate. 80% recidivism rate, which means she will just be back on another corner the next day with the other 50,000 illegal that are coming in and the other 2 million that are already here in this country. So is that really a solution? The incarceration doesn't work. So we first start with, I'll go into some positive actions, just general ones for the United States, and then what Genesis House has done. The San Francisco Task Force did an in-depth study of this because prostitution is a huge problem in San Francisco, as it is in any tourist town or any gambling area where there's money. And they said that they should stop enforcing and prosecuting the misdemeanors of prostitution and the felonies. Now in our area in Illinois, 3 prostitution arrests is a felony. They should dismiss all current prosecutions and reallocate the resources. And I think that's really the key word here, reallocate resources. So what would we do? We would first enforce the laws. We'd use these resources against coercion, blackmail, kidnapping, fraud, rape, and violence, regardless if a person has a status as a prostitute or a sex worker. We would use these redirected resources for the things that women and girls in prostitution really need, which is housing, outreach, job training, and health care services. We would provide adequate resources in this country for domestic violence, homeless, youth, and as we talked about last night, positive messages about sex and sexuality. And we'd also be of more help to immigrants and refugees in this country. We would provide in-service training, and this is key, to not-for-profits about this problem, churches, the police, which we try and do all the time at Genesis House, and the legal system, the public defenders, the judges, and so on. We would provide and promote progressive programs for people like Genesis House. And the way Genesis House came about is we are now the largest organization in the United States, we're very proud of it, that provides services, hospitality, and rehabilitation to women in prostitution. It came about in 1983 where a group of lay missionary women and a priest who had been working in New York actually for 10 years prior to that working with prostitutes, and how he came to work with prostitutes as he was driving through the tunnel and women knocked on his window and he thought they were hitchhiking. So being a good priest, he said, I'll take you safely. And they said, well, what do you want for this? And of course he was like, oh my gosh, you know, he realized he'd picked up prostitutes and decided to work with them. And his name is Father DePaul Jemska. And after that, he appeared on television in the 70s and he appeared, unusually enough, in Hustler magazine as the priest to the hookers, I believe the article was about him. And he's still on our board. And there were 3 or 4 female lay missionaries, one of which was Edwina Gately at that time. So they all got together, and they started really more of a drop-in center and a little kind of halfway house. Then later on, some other people came and started to build the organization, with what was CDC funding, Center for Disease Control, and outreach for HIV. So it began to grow, and as it began to grow, it began to have some very distinct components. The first component, which was never, has never left us, which I always kind of think of it as the bottom of the pyramid, is the spirituality component, which remained to us. Even though we transitioned and we became a 501c3 in the state of Illinois, some of those components remain, where you can come in, and if you need to go to drug treatment, you stay on the couch and we keep you safe and warm. We have a huge hospitality component. We will make sure you get to drug treatment. We will make sure you have a meal. If you're still using or prostituting, we never turn you away from our door. And that's extremely important because, as you know, in a lot of places you come and it's like, well, we'll have a bed in 4 days, or you can talk to a counselor tomorrow. We don't do that at Genesis House. You can talk to someone that day. You can have a meal as soon as someone can get it ready for you, and you can be rest and get clean clothes. And if you're not ready to quit prostituting yet, that's okay. We call this harm reduction, and we would encourage you, obviously, at that time to use condoms and be safe and keep everybody else safe around you. But we won't force you or, proselytize or tell you have to stop. You know, it's like a no-pressure place there. So that's our crisis. We are food pantries. We have three permanent locations in the city of Chicago and a fourth large vehicle that travels around at night. All of those are food pantries, giving food whenever it's needed to the women, and clothing, because oftentimes they're homeless, their clothing is dirty, they need a shower to feel better. And obviously our hope is that they'll identify with us as a place that when they do feel like getting help, when they are ready maybe to make some changes, they'll come to Genesis House. The next component of our programming is case management and or the counseling piece, where when a woman comes in and needs services, we provide linkage to all kinds of organizations and other social service organizations in Chicago, be it domestic violence, if it's usually the request is for substance abuse, drug treatment, if they're HIV positive, services for that, if it's mental health, if it's something with DCFS, Department of Children and Family Services, which is with their children. We keep a lot of linkages and strong collaborations with other organizations in the city of Chicago, psychiatrists, dentists, doctors, all of those people that help us provide services for our women. So we'll be linking them, but in addition, our case managers provide counseling for them. We also provide then health care. We have free nursing, and these are all collaborations either with the Department of Health. The VNA provides our supplies, so we have a lot of different linkages. We don't do this in a vacuum. So we have free nursing on our south side, we have free nursing on our west side, and we have free nursing on our vehicle. That provides hepatitis C testing, HIV testing, and sexually transmitted disease counseling, safe sex kinds of counseling, and again, referrals to a safe place and follow-up. Sometimes in the winter it's free medications for colds, that type of thing, whatever you might need. If we don't feel the person's really going to follow through, especially, and go to the health, we try and provide as much as we can for them there to get rid of what's bothering them. So those are our vehicle was actually an outgrowth of public health initiatives. And this was funding through the Congressional Black Caucus in the United States. And the Congressional Black Caucus is very concerned about the rise of HIV and AIDS in the heterosexual minority population. So the Congressional Black Caucus has been an extreme support to Genesis House, and we were recognized for our excellence in reaching out to a marginalized, difficult-to-reach population. And they have supported us very well and enabled us to buy this gigantic vehicle. Word of caution, I know some people are thinking about starting programs. Every vehicle is another big headache. Another crash, another broken window. But I always kind of cringe when we get a new vehicle. I think we have three now. And, you know, how long will it be till we're calling the insurance agent? But anyway, we have this very, very large vehicle. It's 42 feet. It's an SUV. It goes around the city, or RV, I'm sorry, RV. And it has a slide. It has a television, a video for video trainings. It has a private office for the nurse and the case manager. It has an outreach workers that go out to the street, find the women if they're sick or they're hurting or they need help or they're running away from someone. It is a safe place to be and it is a safe place to get on. We're very blessed to have that because our outreach workers used to go out without any protection on the streets, just cell phones and pagers. And oftentimes people approach them for safety and they weren't really that safe. So we feel so blessed to have this big vehicle now. It also has a bathroom, a kitchen, a microwave, all of those things. So whatever the women need. What we tend to see in the vehicle is younger people. Younger people feel a lot more comfortable for whatever reason staying in their neighborhood and coming to a vehicle as opposed to coming to our door. We know that prostitution in Chicago, some of it's gang-related, and that might be one of the reasons to cross into different territories and other kinds of things. But we do see a lot more young people on our vehicle. We also see, unfortunately, a lot more young people using needles nowadays on our vehicle. So it's, but at least they're coming. They mostly come for condoms when they come on the vehicle. The next phase of our programming is what we call our long-term residential program. We started with 4 beds, it became 8 beds, and we just recently acquired another 22 beds, which we have money pending now, grants pending now to open, so keep your fingers crossed, say a prayer for us. We'll know September if we got HUD funding to open this, and actually we have 3 or 4 grants pending for this, but the day programming's open there, and the residential program starts with a woman going to her case manager, as I told you before. Normally, the first contact is by an outreach worker. Our outreach workers are all women who have recovered from prostitution and substance abuse. You must be out of prostitution and substance abuse for a minimum of 5 years to become an outreach worker, and you would have needed to hold a job elsewhere. So these women then are required to take Red Cross training, domestic violence training, and get a lot of different certifications so that they all share a similar body of knowledge. Not only do they have their own experiential knowledge, but then they do share body of knowledge, which they're taught, and we send them to ongoing counseling education. So our outreach workers are very, very effective. One of them, in fact, Gloria Moya, was just on a television show called Local Heroes because she's one of our graduates, and she has been an outreach worker for about, I want to say 9 years now. She's been threatened at knife point. All kinds of things have happened to her. And she continues to work as an outreach worker because she loves the work. So she was honored for that on television just a few months ago. So they come out and they are living proof also to the women on the street that your life can be turned around. You know, I did it. You can do it. And it's a real inspiration to the women that are out there working to see that it happens and you get well and you get better and you get a job and so on. So we really treasure our outreach workers and their devotion because it's hard work. They also go into the jails and they go into the courtrooms and advocate. We have a court advocacy program, which we started in the city of Chicago, which is called Unhooked. That program is where we ask the judge or the woman, we present the program to the woman. If she wants to come to our program unhooked, the judge then does not arrest her. She's out on bond, and she needs to follow up with our programming and then come back and present that she's been at Genesis House. That's a phenomenal program because, first of all, the women who come to the Unhooked program had no intention of stopping prostituting. They just happened to be arrested, really. It was just sort of circumstance. However, then we find that about 50% of the women who come to Genesis House spend a day with us. We provide a meal. We provide a variety of counseling and linkage to services. Come back to us for further services, which is really a great and high number. And we're really proud of that. And Tracy's not here. She has been in charge of our court program, and she's doing a phenomenal job. We now have referrals from more than 29 judges at last count in the city of Chicago. So what, on the positive note, that tells you is that, you know, they aren't necessarily the bad guys. They really aren't. There's just haven't been options. There haven't been options that they had other than jail. And if you really think about it, that's what you really need. A judge needs something or, you know, a public defender needs something that he can hang on to give someone an alternative. If there's no alternative, the only alternative is incarceration. So we're working very hard on really setting up a national model for this type of court advocacy program so that it really starts to spread around the United States. There's a very good one in Hawaii, which we got a copy of, that's, I think, 8-week program, which we'd really like to do to have a lot of impact on the women and have in our programming for 8 weeks. So when they come to us for long-term residential, they've met someone from Genesis House, either in the courts or in the jails or somewhere, and they decide they want to come into long-term rehab. The case manager sits down and does an assessment. Then if she's using drugs or alcohol, which is pretty much the norm, we do require that you go to a 21 or 28-day treatment program, and we monitor you in that program and make sure you're making progress and you stayed off drugs and alcohol. Then you're admitted to Genesis House to a 3-phase program. The first 30 days are what we call orientation. It's a fairly strict program. You have to get up in the morning. You have to cook and clean and be part of numerous in-house groups and groups that are not in the house. So the participant has to decide if this is what she wants to do, if she wants to make this commitment. Because some people don't. You know, it's too rigid or it's too structured and they don't want to be there. So the person who really makes the commitment to us really does want to be there. So for 30 days, we do orientation, and then at any time, if you want to leave or leave us, that's fine. It's not right for you. Then after that, you begin phase one, which is where we do all the initial, what do you need? You know, do you need job training? Do you need HIV service? Do you need dental work? Do you need to be linked up with a church? I mean, are your children in DCFS custody? Do you need parenting classes? And so on. So we individualize. Are you an incest survivor? Do you need specific incest survivor therapy? Do you have some type of emotional problem? And then we will link you with all of those things for more intensified counseling, maybe psychiatric care. It might be psychiatric meds. No one is ruled out from being with us if they're on psychiatric meds, but we really try at that point to really individualize. What is your individual problem? You know, some women may have college training. Some may not have a GED. So you really do have to figure out what that person needs individually. From that point on, they're not allowed to work for 6 months in our programming. And a lot of people have taken issue with that. But the real reason is that if you ask the women, have you ever held a job, they've all held jobs. They've all held many, many, many jobs, legitimate jobs. It's not, you know, can you go out and get a job? The real issue is, why do you always lose your job? Why do you lose your job? Why do you start to take drugs and alcohol? Why do you slip back and start to prostitute? That's the issue. Not can you go out tomorrow and get a job? You know, that's easy to do, you know. So we really work on that self-discovery and self-exploration and finding out and really facing all the bad things that have happened. And, you know, for anybody who can imagine what's happened in their lives, 6 months is not nearly enough time to do that. But we are one of the longest programs in the United States, which you start to figure out what happened, who you're angry at, who hurt you, and, you know, eventually even start to work through to forgiveness through different programming. For spirituality, we have different people that come to us from a variety of churches. We have Jesuits, for example, and who create positive male role modeling for the women. So they lead us in spirituality. We've had women in ministries come to us. Ingrid has been a volunteer at Genesis House helping us out. But it is non-denominational, and it's whoever, whatever you believe in. We don't force anyone to go to any type of church or anything like that or practice in any way. But spirituality is a component that they're exposed to. Things like art therapy, we have volunteers that do art therapy. We're so blessed. We have people with master's degree in psychology that do life skills. We have all kinds of people that come in and provide really valuable work for us and help us to help our women, just like Holden Village is helping us now. So in the long-term residential, the second phase is when you think about a job that's appropriate for you and that Genesis House approves of and that we feel will not be demeaning, and we try and work with whoever they're going to. We work with women in trades. We work with different organizations that place women who have been victims of violence or have been marginalized. So we hook up with them and work through them to place the women in jobs. Then once you get a job, a third of the money goes to Genesis House for your rent. You begin to pay rent. A third we save in a savings account for when you graduate. And then a third is their spending money at that time. So at the time you do work is the only time you pay for any service at Genesis House. So then we get ready pretty much for your graduation. The biggest obstacle to graduation is fair housing and low-income housing, because I imagine for all of you, wherever you come from, low-income housing is really a challenge, and that's always our biggest challenge, is finding a place where they can live safely with their children, where they won't be in a neighborhood that's, you know, filled with crack and all kinds of things that are negative for them, so to try and really get them into a healthy environment. When they move through and they with the case manager and the director of residence, decide on what their different things will be when they decide that they have made it, that they've graduated. Graduated is 12 to 14 months. It's not only getting a job, there's also certain things that you have to, maybe it's an issue with sexuality that would have to be under control. Maybe it's an issue with substance abuse. It all has to be under control, and you have to be on the right road. So we do random drug checks in our programming. So if the women are found to be positive, that would be a setback to another phase. We don't make people leave, which is a little bit different, which is back to our spirituality base. We work with you, but if you refuse to go back into treatment or something like that, we would ask you to leave if you have relapsed while you were in the program. But otherwise, we'll work with you if you're willing to start over and go back into treatment and stay within the programming. So once they've reached their goals, whatever their goals were, and goals that we set for them, and they're always mutually agree upon goal, we have what we call graduation, which is a really joyous, wonderful day at Genesis House. All the relatives, anybody can be invited. All our former graduates are invited. All the staff is invited. And the women work for a long time cooking and getting ready for this big graduation celebration that we have. The way it works, we like the residents themselves to perform or sing or do something. We have a vase that's one woman is African American, the other woman is Caucasian, and the heads are fused together. And it's a vase where we bring big bouquets of flowers, and with each flower we put in the vase, we say something about the person and what they've accomplished and how well they've done and what a good job they've done. And it takes a tremendous amount of work to do this and strength to really do what they do. And family speaks and children speaks and people cry and people sing. It's really wonderful. Then we have a big pile of gifts. It's almost like, just moving into your first apartment. So there'll be towels and alarm clocks and whatever you need. gift certificates to Target are always like fully appreciated, you know, things of that nature. And then usually Wanda, God bless her heart, takes the big old van, the 16-seater, and physically moves you into your house. We physically move you and make sure you're safe there. And then Wanda checks on you. And she checks on you every so often, every so many weeks, to make sure you're okay. Beyond that, we do long-term follow-up that is free. Everything is free, which is key. We know that when there's an intervention, we know by psychology and sociology that people, their acceptance will rise, but then once they're back in a challenging situation, it becomes more difficult for people when they're really paying bills and paying for meals and taking care of their children. That's when we want to be of the most support. We want you to come back. Everything's free. Come back for a meal. Come back for all your 12-step groups. Come back for all your counseling. Counseling's free. Clothing's free. Groceries are free. Everything, again, is free for you. Thank you. And that's a fundamental part of our program, that every service is free up until the time you're working, and every service after that is free. And I can't emphasize that enough, because people are much more likely to come if it's between that money for the meal for the baby and it's the money for the counseling session. It's going to be the money for the baby, and we intrinsically understand that at Genesis House. So one of our now proposed programs after follow-up is we're proposing programming for a Johns program in the city of Chicago. That is because, as I mentioned earlier, there needs to be a lot of work around this area and what compels men to do these kinds of things. We also want to look at the fact that some people are unhappy doing what they're doing. They do want help, They're endangering their family structure if they're married, which many, many men are. These people have been violent with prostitutes, have been violent elsewhere. Statistics show us that they've been violent either in domestic violence, battery, and assault charges. So it's also a way of looking at a person who's problematic for society, who is, again, it's a supply and demand situation, who is demanding that service and saying, maybe this person needs some healthy sexual attitudes. Maybe this person needs to be looked at, what is the violence, what is happening here, and move away from puritanical Victorian attitudes of, you know, putting this, now I guess they put your face on the internet, that's the newest thing I heard in one city, and they print your name in the paper, and they take your car away, and they do all these, you know, punishing kinds of things that anybody knows that, and we know this even from children, you know, punishing doesn't teach you anything. And usually people have come from some type of dysfunction themselves. That's why they really don't know anybody better or aren't doing any better. And I did have the pleasure of reading the surveys from the San Francisco program, John's program, of the men who respond. And not one of those men didn't have something positive to say about the John's program, how they had learned something, how they saw things differently, how they would now teach their children differently, which I think key here is to teach your children to think differently about sexuality and getting along with other people. So that's another positive approach. We not only like say, okay, the women need services and help, perhaps the customers need help and services. And we would like to set that up in Chicago just like a DUI program. And it would be the same thing. When you're caught with drunken driving, you go into a class. There's an extra ticket or fine added to it. So the customer's paying for it. It doesn't make the taxpayer pay for anything. And he benefits from it. And I think if you look at it and you're attacking it from both ends of the spectrum, you're bound to make more of an impact than just focusing on one population and just one half of it. It really does. We don't attack other problems like this, so it really doesn't make sense in prostitution to just attack it from one end. The way the curriculum goes is it begins with a public health person who scares you to death, you know, shows all kinds of horrible diseases and films and everything like that. Then it's the public defender who again scares you to death because he talks about all the legal ramifications for what you've just done and if you keep doing it, what's going to happen to you. Then it gets a little nicer and it's a panel of former prostitutes who tell men how they feel about them, how they felt doing this, and what a horrible experience it was. So the delusion that somebody's enjoying this is gone forever. And many of the women will say, you know, I was HIV positive and you paid me $20 more not to wear a condom and I didn't care. I didn't care if you got HIV positive because you know what? I hate you. You know, so it's a real eye opener for people to hear that. Then there is usually a male psychotherapist that works with sexual compulsivity issues and tells the men where they can get more help for these addictive kinds of behaviors or the behaviors that are self-destructive to them and their family. And then finally, a single prostitute who is in recovery talks. And I happened to meet her, and she would stand up and say, what do you think a heroin addict looks like? You know, and they'd all say these, you know, degrading things. And she'd say, like me? And they'd say, oh, no, not like you. And then she'd say, what do you think a prostitute looks like? And, you know, they'd say all these things. And she'd say, like me? Does she look like me? Oh, no, not like you. And she'd go, well, would you be surprised to know that I was a heroin addict and a prostitute for 20 years? And everybody just, oh. And it also tells you what discriminatory misconceptions we have, you know, about people. And when someone gets well, they get well. And you would never know anything about the past or the past things that have happened. So she says, this is the face of someone who's well and in recovery, and this is what I look like, and this is what can happen. So that program has something like a 97% success rate of men not being rearrested again. And they keep those statistics in San Francisco. Finally, I just like, some people have asked me about funding because I know there's a lot of interest among the ministry and the community about how could something like this get started in your community. I will tell you, a lot of the major funding for this types of program does come from community public health initiatives. there, especially because of HIV, the rise of hepatitis C, needle usage, and sexually transmitted diseases. However, that's not the only place. We get money from domestic violence funding. We receive money from church groups who really believe in what we do and foundations. We get money from a variety of foundations such as Sara Lee, Polk Brothers, the Chicago Tribune Foundation, just to mention a few. And almost any foundation that has an interest in women and children's well-being, an interest in homelessness, and an interest in physical health. So we kind of can go around and find different sources. We've also had in the past money from HUD, which is specifically housing in the United States, and provides the housing end. We get a lot of funding through Congressional Black Caucus that went through CSAT-SAMHSA, which is the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment in the United States, which is a very large organization that works arm in arm with the Center for Disease Control in Washington. So there are ways to look at this. A lot of times there is not specifically money for prostitution. No, you won't normally see a grant for prostitution, but it might be those at risk for something. You know, those are the kinds that you look for, although the healthcare grants do specifically target women in prostitution. We started very small as a small little drop-in place and grew just in increments, you know, little by little by little, and just got bigger and provided more and more. And that's how basically we came to be so as large as we are. And we also, I think my employees do an astounding job, a phenomenal job, which is another reason why we were able to grow, because our programming, our residential, has a 70% success rate of women staying out of prostitution and drugs. And some of those statistics go back as far as 10 years. We're very blessed to be able to trace people for a long time because some of them work for us at our office. So we know it's not just a one-year thing or a two-year thing. It's a 10-year proposition that they've stayed off of drugs and prostitution. And in addition to that, just to give you an idea, we saw more than 20,000 contacts last year of women and girls in the city of Chicago. There is an estimated 50,000 men, women, and children in prostitution in Chicago. So there's lots of work to be done. You can have excellent results. And I ask if anyone has any questions or any discussion about our programming. Thank you. I apologize for my throat. Questions? Discussion?
How many programs like Genesis House or sort of similar to Genesis House are there in the country?
There's probably about 8 large ones and then hundreds of smaller, you know, different, like there's drop-in centers or there's ministries, and there's large ones in New York, Baltimore, Florida, Oregon, Washington, San Francisco, and I think Dallas. And then other around the country, we often have inquiries how to help people set up programs. That's one thing I do. I do consulting, and I help other states and other people to set up this type of programming. And so there's lots of little fledgling ones. Now, I mean, judging by how many calls I get from Cleveland, Australia, I think there's a Genesis House in Australia, actually. Canada has some big programming as well. But you see a lot of smaller ones that people are just kind of getting the idea that maybe this is good programming. I think we're really at where domestic violence was about 20, 25 years ago. I think that's where prostitution is now, where people are just kind of starting to realize the child abuse part of it, the disease part of it, you know, that there is a turnaround, that women can be rehabilitated. They have a high probability of rehab. Because again, they're nonviolent offenders. They're mostly victims. They're victimized, so they really haven't gone out and done anything terribly, terribly horrible. And they're wanting an opportunity. 89%, by the way, of women who are incarcerated for prostitution charges say if there was a program, they would get out. Some studies show higher, 95%. So that's another thing. They want out. They want programming. We just haven't created it. You know, we really have to create it. And I find, I just want to tell you, a lot of support from judges, public defenders, police, domestic violence shelters. People really support doing something positive about it. They really do. And a lot of people get behind you. We even have CAPS behind us now, pretty much. not all members, but a lot of people from camps. But I think there's a lot of, you know, little fledgling ones all over.
Since last night, I was thinking about this, and I can think of, like, because I have three daughters, and I know other people in it, sort of inappropriate behavior in, well, I guess, yeah, mostly men in our society, and we accept that as normal, or we don't talk about it. So I was thinking public education, just for the general public. We talked about it last night with children in schools, but we don't do anything as a general public. So certain behaviors aren't healthy, and there are places that you can get help, or...
I agree. I know that when I do speak in schools and ask girls if they know anyone, I do get a lot of inquiries. I give them my card. I tell them where to go for counseling and help. And I know it's them. It's not their friend. And I think that a lot more of that needs to be done. And I think a lot of times, and I think, again, this isn't a male bashing kind of thing either. You know, I think that a lot of men... didn't learn something in their home that you know, was inappropriate, or their dad yelled at women, or, you know, whatever it was. And I think it is a mutual relationship, and it's a teaching kind of thing. And that's why I'm so dogmatic about kids, because, you know, once we've really abused kids and really done a lot to their psyche in their developmental years, it's really hard to, you know, start going back at 28 and 30 and undo a lot of that damage, you know. So I think the real beginning is we've got to start protecting our kids, you know. We just, and, you know, just not trusting them with people we even think are trustworthy sometimes, and really find out what's going on with them. Because that's, once you get those unhealthy messages and things, it takes years of psychotherapy and, you know, to try and get well from that kind of messaging. So, you know, we know this is passed down generationally from, you know, bad habits passed down. And we also know that child molesters have a very low rate of reform for whatever reason. And, you know, they're still trying to work, and right now they're trying to work on new progressive programming, because that's why people are so upset when they get into their neighborhoods, because most people know the statistics. They have a low rate of rehab. And there's lots of progressive ideas going on, and I've read a lot of different things, but, you know, we'll see what the rates of recovery are.
One of the issues in the public mind is regard to prostitution in some cities, and I think this is particularly the case in large cities with first and second ring suburbs, is the impact on neighborhoods, and therefore the response, the official response is often displacement. That's what the point of you know, publicizing John's names and those sorts of things. Do you have any perspective on that, and or statistics or sense of how your program impacts neighborhoods? Is that something you're worried about at all? Or?
In terms of I think it impacts neighborhoods, because statistically, when prison has an 80% recidivism rate, for example, or incarceration, and we have a 70% success rate, it's the only way, you know, you may move them to another corner or another, or the job goes somewhere else, but the numbers are still just growing when you do that. You know, you haven't done an intervention that stops it.
Yeah.
So I think our intervention is one that stops it. So therefore, you're not putting more numbers on top of numbers, you know, and just displacing people to other places, because people don't stop. It's like anything else, without some type of meaningful, well-crafted intervention. That makes sense, and that's why we hit it on so many, court, you know, jail, rehab, jobs, health. You know, we try to hit it on every, you know, perspective, so it works.
That's, you know, obviously extremely intuitive and makes good sense, but I'm just wondering whether you try to sort of look at from a more sort of, maybe more sort of middle-class neighborhood perspective, whether you try to use that as a rationale for justification. So, I mean, where you are, that's maybe not an issue, but it would be if you were doing your work in, I can't remember my Chicago geography, but a first or second suburb of, say, Chicago, you know.
Well, actually, there is. I speak in the suburbs, and I go out to the suburbs. There's a lot of prostitution in Rockford. There's a lot of prostitution in Aurora. There's a lot in Gurnee. So actually, in Rogers Park, there's and the wealthy neighborhoods. I mean, Bucktown, for example, has become a very wealthy neighborhood in Chicago, where there's tons of interaction with us and the citizens policing and getting them to support us with the courts. Because obviously, what we want from the support, then we want funding from the city, yeah, so that we can have more of an impact. Because the real thing that makes the impacts is taking people off the streets and getting them out of this horrific environment and taking care of them in a safe place for as long as you can until they get well. And that's what really makes the impact, truly.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of programs are just 21 days, 28 days, and then you're out and you're back on the street, but where do you go? You know, you don't have anywhere to go to get well. So I think that's the key, that, and when you could kind of show the jail, for example, and with a couple things tacked on, it is around 32,000 per women. Our program for years, like 16, they have an 80% recidivism rate. We have a 70% success rate. It's less money and it's more successful. So, I mean, there's some real, concrete kinds of arguments, too, other than caring about your fellow man, which, you know, and woman, which should be the first one. But, you know, there's other reasons why it makes sense to. Ted Koppel did a show on this when he did California women's prisons. I don't know if any of you remember that. And what was interesting is I usually say how much money it costs, but at the end he said, we could have sent her to Harvard rather than locking her up for a year. Now think about that, to Harvard. You know, so if that money was spent on rehab, think of the success rate. And you wouldn't have to spend as much as you spend locking the person up either to rehab them. So I don't, you know, it's interesting that there's some real logical reasons to do this, but it's a tough fight.
This is a little bit left over from last night's discussion. I heard several people talk about, it's you because I was looking down from the top, but maybe, did you have all white on and a blue kerchief? And you made a comment about, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Michelle.
That self-esteem was the most important part of a healthy attitude of mind. And then I'm hearing people talk about the kids in high school and how captive they are with all this, and you can't do sex education, or you can do certain kinds of sex education in school, but you can't talk about emotional and spiritual aspects. And I don't know if you're coming from a dysfunctional family and the children get eroded at that point to make them susceptible to poor life choices. What is another arena where that self-esteem can be nurtured? If they drop out of school, maybe it isn't the schools. I don't know.
I agree with you. I think that's a challenge for us.
How do you instill the self-esteem early on if they can't get it from their nuclear family?
I think that's like I think all these community efforts and community centers, and I think the key is a lot in outreach. I really find from our vehicle, it's going out. You have to find them. I don't think once they've dropped out of school, they're necessarily going to come back to the school. Maybe they're not comfortable in church any longer. So I'm a big proponent of outreach efforts to tie them in somehow. You know, we were even looking at starting a program, for example, with juvenile court. And once they kind of end up some way connected with juvenile court to begin this kind of... But I do feel that, because we actually did a study with youth. I was given a grant about that. And what we really found, we were going to open a program for youth at a stationary site where they'd have to travel to. And all the questionnaires and feedback from the youth were like, no, we won't come. So don't bother. You know, come to us, or come where we are, or come where we're comfortable.
Is it possible to catch them before they fall through the cracks?
Well, I think if you have a student,
kids in school,
I think we should have a lot more school counselors and a lot more school social workers, frankly. I mean, that's a personal bias, but a lot of times when I have a private practice as well, and when I get really disturbed people, they were never weeded out in school. I had one woman, just for example, she didn't talk for 1 year in school, one whole year, and became psychotic when she was about 21 or 22, but no one ever took her to a counselor until she was talking to the television and it was talking back, you know, things of that nature were happening at home. You know, then they brought her for therapy, but it's kind of like no one noticed she didn't talk for a year. So I do think we need to really have more school social workers, more school psychologists, a lot more of that helping kids.
Oh. Yeah, I was just wondering exactly how big you are at the Genesis House as an organization.
We have four sites. One of them is in Mobile. We have approximately 40 employees. I'm the ED. We have directors under me of all different programming of the public health initiatives, of the residential care and so on. And then under them are supervisors, and then there's case managers and house coordinators and managers and the residences and drivers. There's drivers and nurses.
Are you starting in 1983, right?
With about five people.
And then, how many women have been through the programs?
Well, graduates probably around 100, and then just because we had less beds, we had to place people in other programming. So every year, we saw 30 to 60,000, and when we had CDC funding, but we have to place a lot of people out because we don't have beds.
So how many people stay there?
We now have 32 beds, and we're just opening. We have 8, and we're opening 22 more.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.